Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. On tonight's program, an overview of a cancer that is on the rise, bladder cancer.
The biggest and strongest factor in bladder cancer is actually environmental exposure. And by that, I mean the elephant in the room is smoking.
Plus, a surgeon and his patient discuss a complex procedure to replace a cancerous bladder.
What was relatively uncommon for this area is creation of a new bladder out of the patient's intestines.
And advancements that allow for better study of brain tissue and its function.
It's incredibly promising, and especially if you couple it with next generation genetic sequencing so that we understand the blueprint of tissue.
How to safely dispose of unused prescription medications and a thought-provoking selection from our healing muse. Well, that's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we learn all about a dramatic surgical treatment for cancer of the bladder, plus how recent breakthroughs in the creation of a three-dimensional brain tissue may help unlock the secrets of neurological diseases like Alzheimer's. But first, all about that silent killer, bladder cancer. Bladder cancer. It's the sixth most common cancer in the United States. And this year alone, it's estimated that more than 74,000 Americans will be diagnosed with bladder cancer, and more than 15,000 will die of the disease. And it's on the rise. Well, here with more on this and how to prevent this deadly disease is Dr. Srinivas Vorganti. He's the assistant professor of urology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Vorganti. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
So help us understand first, what exactly is bladder cancer?
So I'm going to start by just explaining what the bladder is. It sounds like there is a organ in your body that you depend on every day that you don't really think about, and that's a good thing. You make urine constantly. Every heartbeat, the kidneys, which filter the blood, make small amounts of urine consistently. But it's not in our benefit to produce urine or leak out this urine all the time. So what the bladder's job is to store this urine to a point that is convenient to us, and several times a day, different frequency and different timing based on how much urine you make, it switches from that storage function to an emptying function. And so the bladder sits in the pelvis, in between our hips, essentially, and stores this urine for several hours at a time. Now, what cancers can form because as toxins in our body are filtered out, some of the toxins come out in the urine. And the bladder is exposed to these toxins at a relatively higher rate than other elements of the body.
Is that also because it's a repository? The way you've described it, it's kind of a holding tank.
Absolutely.
For these toxins, if the kidney, you know, kind of filters them out of our body, and it ends up in the urine then goes to the bladder. It may sit there for hours, even at a time, because we don't void most of us don't void every hour kind of thing. So that means the bladder then is more exposed in a concentrated way to some of these toxins.
And that's the very reason why you might not think of it, but why the bladder is especially susceptible to injury from toxins. And so where the most common bladder cancers start, at least in the United States, are from the lining of the bladder, which you can think of as similar to the lining of your cheek. It's a very smooth, it's a mucosal layer. And on occasion, there can be growths, which are cancerous, that happen from this, from genetic injury to this lining.
So let's back up. So when you say genetic injury, are you suggesting that people are born with a predisposition or a family
likelihood to develop a bladder cancer, or is it mostly in response to an external exposure, such as a toxin?
Absolutely. So there are combinations of this. So there are certainly, as the march of science goes on, there are definitely underlying genetic injuries that lead to cancer. That doesn't necessarily mean that the genetics or your hereditary is driving it. And the biggest and strongest factor in bladder cancer is actually environmental exposure. And by that, I mean the elephant in the room is smoking. And then secondarily are toxins that we're exposed to over life. Different individuals have different ability to repair or sustain these injuries.
However, not everyone is as susceptible. You given two people, one might be somewhat more, by their genetics, be more susceptible to that toxin.
Absolutely.
And someone else might be more resilient to that toxin. But the fact is, the toxin is really what is promoting the development of the cancer.
Absolutely.
So this is a shocking statement to me, because as a novice, as a, you know, a non-medical person, to hear that smoking can be associated with something like bladder cancer. I mean, I would think that people in the field know that, but I'd say the common everyday person really doesn't associate smoking with bladder cancer. More it's smoking with lung cancer or cancers of the mouth, the oral cavity, what have you.
This is almost a universal sentiment I get from my patients, is an underappreciation of the fact that something so common, it's not rare by any means. The economic impact is the most of any cancer.
Why is that?
Well, the reason is that when you are diagnosed with bladder cancer, its treatment, which we will be talking about soon, it has a tendency to come back. And the way we have to watch for it, and the surveillance, and its tendency to recur, like the analogy I give to people, it's like weeds. You pick the weeds or you remove the weeds, but it can grow back. And there is an intense surveillance that has to happen to prevent its progressing.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with urologist Dr. Srinivas Varganti, and we're talking about bladder cancer. Now, why, first of all, do you think it's on the rise? Or is it in fact on the rise? Or is it just that we're better at finding it?
I do believe it's on the rise. It's hard to know exactly why the absolute numbers of things go up. In general, bladder cancer is a cancer as of age. And so there we have talked about who is at risk. Certainly people who are smokers the other thing is it's associated with gender. So males are 2 to 3 times more likely to get it in their lifetime.
And we don't necessarily know why that is either.
Yeah, there are many ideas about that. And the role of female hormones in studying the biology of the disease.
They may be more protective.
There is potentially a more protective element. However, when I say that, it's important to me to also mention that women who get the disease, much like with heart disease, there's an underappreciation, especially because the number one symptom of having bladder cancer, blood in the urine, can often be mistaken for benign
right.
gynecologic
exactly.
symptoms. And when women
thereby are, be overlooked.
Absolutely. And as smoking is on the rise in women, which is felt to be a huge public health issue, women are understood to also be sort of the unsung or underappreciated sufferers of bladder cancer. So it's important as we go through, just because it's more common in men, that we can't forget that women are also important sufferers of this disease.
So when you say sufferers, let's talk about this idea of symptoms. You mentioned this, what they call hematuria,
yeah,
which
absolutely.
Is a little bit of blood in
yes,
the urine.
Yes, and I apologize for using the medical term.
No, I think I said it. Yeah.
Blood in the urine is essentially the number one cause. And if you see blood in the urine, it's never normal. It's often painless, and sometimes it is something that comes and goes. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have cancer, because there are other reasons you can have blood in the urine.
Like a urinary tract infection.
A urinary tract infection, a stone. There are very, very common other reasons, but it is a reason, especially if you can see it, to go see a urologist so this can all be sorted out.
So let's get to that. How is it sorted out? I mean, obviously blood in the urine and then sometimes pain along with it can be very concerning. And some people have frequent urinary tract infections with hematuria, with blood in the urine. So what do you recommend? You say go to urologist. Obviously, you want to start with your primary care physician.
Absolutely.
But what are the steps to diagnosis of the cancer?
So much like most cancers, the most important thing to decide is when you have blood in the urine is what is the source. And this is sorted out with a number of tests. So like most cancers, there's a combination of x-rays, urine and blood tests, and a camera that's inserted into the bladder. It sounds very dramatic, but it's actually done, it's very painless. It's uncomfortable, but it's done with numbing medicine. It's done awake, and it's done routinely in a urologist's office.
And that's called a cystoscopy.
That's called a cystoscopy.
And they go in basically with a little camera to see what inside the bladder, to see what the lining looks like?
Absolutely. And the reason for this is that a direct inspection, much like colonoscopy, a direct inspection of the mucosal lining of the bladder, which is irregular and is a balloon, it's difficult to inspect just with x-rays.
So that's really kind of the gold standard.
Absolutely.
And then is there always a biopsy taken? I know in colonoscopy, often they do take any suspicious tissue.
If something is identified as being abnormal, it is removed. Most of the time, especially if it does look like a cancer, this would require you to come back on another day, undergo an anesthesia for comfort, and this area is removed. And the most important question is, what is it? There are many different types of bladder cancer. There are many different aggressiveness of bladder cancer, range of aggressiveness.
So the cell type is important.
And the depth of invasion. So I mentioned that it starts in the lining of the bladder, and probably about half of cancers as they're identified are just in that lining. But they can also, as they progress, invade into the deeper layers, into the muscle of the bladder and the area around the bladder. And on occasion, more rarely, thankfully, they can be identified as having spread beyond the bladder.
So they could metastasize, so to speak,
exactly.
And then they become rampant throughout the body.
Exactly. And each level of depth of invasion is associated with worse outcomes. So this is something for those half of people that are identified of having the cancer in only the lining, often a scraping and other medicines that are given in the bladder can be used to save the bladder with close observation.
So that's the point that you made. The importance of surveillance will continue because I guess there's a tendency for recurrence.
Absolutely.
Once you've been diagnosed with it. So what are the treatments? Just very briefly, I don't want to run out of time. Basically, there's obviously some surgical.
Yeah.
And then how about things like chemotherapy and immunotherapy, I heard was being done.
Absolutely. So the mainstay of treatment is tailored and individualized to each patient. So when you become a bladder cancer survivor and you're fighting bladder cancer, you can be overwhelmed by the amount of different options. If it's more extensive, then a surgical removal of the bladder is often recommended because this is associated with a great survival outcome. Some people are not candidates for this, and there are other bladder-sparing therapies, which can be given with a combination of systemic chemotherapy and radiation to the bladder, that can also be used. Choosing between these choices, between saving the bladder with scraping it out and medicines in the bladder, and surgery over radiation is a very challenging decision and needs to be done with discussion with your doctor.
Yeah. So let's talk about prevention. We have only a little bit of time left. What are the key points to remember?
The number one thing I have to explain to patients is they really need to stop smoking. Smoking cessation is a big movement in the bladder cancer advocacy community, and we cannot forget about it. Luckily, we are growing off of other lung cancer and oropharyngeal cancers. People know that it causes cancer, so we can grow off of that.
And also avoid exposure to some industrial chemicals.
Absolutely.
If you can,
yeah.
Obviously. And with OSHA rules, more and more, the workplace is becoming safer.
And then the other thing, it's important to get close medical care, partner with your primary care provider. If this is something if you're susceptible to cancers, something to just keep in your mind. And just be educated about it.
So. And a very healthy lifestyle, obviously. Drink plenty of fluids, water, and eat healthy fruits and vegetables. But that's true for everything.
That's absolutely true for everything.
I want to thank you for coming in. This is very enlightening and important information. My guest has been Dr. Srinivas Vorganti. He's assistant professor of urology at Upstate Medical University. Once again, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Next, a dramatic surgical treatment for bladder cancer. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Bladder cancer is a silent killer, but there are successful treatments for it. And here with more about an aggressive and dramatic treatment are Dr. Gennady Bratslavsky, professor and chair of urology at Upstate Medical University, and Alan Sester, a bladder cancer survivor. Welcome to you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Dr. B, let me start with you, Dr. Bratslavsky. Help us understand why and how bladder cancer can become so life-threatening.
Bladder cancer, while it starts on the inside of the bladder, has a propensity to spread as it initially grows deeper into a wall of a bladder, and then it can invade not only adjacent organs, it can also go what we call in a systemic disease, and it can also include lymph nodes. The bladder cancer can spread into lungs, lymph nodes, it can go into a liver, and pretty much any other organ.
So it can be a devastating cancer.
It can
cancer.
Become a devastated, widely spread, what we call metastatic cancer, for which the treatment options are very limited, as well as the survival is quite poor.
Especially once it's metastasized.
Especially when it's metastasized.
Mr. Sester, you are a bladder cancer survivor, and you're here for a particular reason to tell us your story. Tell us what happened to you.
Well, I had was feeling great. I had begun having symptoms, some leakage, and this went on for quite a while. I was being treated for a large enlarged prostate because they said, you're an old guy, this happens. I was sent to a urologist who said the same thing. A year passed, and one day I came in and I went to the bathroom and I urinated blood. That got my attention. I was given a CAT scan. It was found that there was a cancer. I was given the options of surgery, chemo, radiation. I wanted none of it. I ran away to Texas for alternate treatment. I figured there's not doing that to me. I went down to Texas, spent everything I had, and grew a brand new tumor. Came back, and the VA removed the second tumor, and that's when they told me about Dr. Bratslavsky and this procedure. Their feeling was that I would be a good candidate and that I could avoid the bag, which was my biggest concern. Once I heard that, I was 100% on board. I didn't care if I was the guinea pig. I didn't. All I knew was that I had an option. They felt very comfortable in recommending me to Dr. Bratslavsky, and I just, having no experience in the field, I had no idea if I should be afraid or not. I just saw it as a fantastic opportunity, given what I had to deal with. And so I was most happy to proceed.
So what was this? What was this new procedure or procedure? And what were his treatment options, as he started to allude?
Right. So Mr. Sester indeed have what is called a muscle-invasive bladder cancer, the one that grew into a muscle. His options, as he mentioned, included chemotherapy upfront with the bladder removal. It included chemotherapy with the radiation treatment. It included bladder removal only. And as my Mr. Sestera mentioned to you, there are many alternative therapies that unfortunately are not FDA approved. We did subject Mr. Sestera eventually to chemotherapy after we have learned that his tumor did go into the lymph node, but that we learned only after the removal of the bladder.
So what made you think about this procedure, which is not a common one?
So the cystectomy itself actually is quite a common procedure for those that have bladder cancer.
A cystectomy meaning a removal
of the bladder and the prostate and seminal vesicles and ampullar vas deferens, and of course removal of the lymph nodes that come with it. What was relatively uncommon for this area is creation of a neobladder, which is a creation of a new bladder out of the patient's intestines. And that is not something that is commonly offered or has been offered in this area. We certainly offer this to our patients at Upstate Medical University at the Urology Department here. And what it involves is pretty much using about 60 centimeters of patient's intestine that will be configured into a sphere form, into a round shape structure, just like a bladder, that will later be connected to the patient's urethra so they could actually void or urinate as they would with their normal bladder. And we also attach kidneys to that sphere made out of intestines. So patients have no bag. And the fact that we did it using a robotic assistance, and Mr. Sestera's largest incision is less than an inch probably, we have been able to avoid a lot of what we call morbidity and post-operative pain, and hopefully get him back to a normal level of activity relatively soon.
So let me just restate it as a layperson. And with a relatively minimally invasive procedure using robotics, you were able to repurpose a part, use a part of his intestine, create or reconstruct a new bladder, and he's good to go?
He pretty much so far has been good to go. Of course, in the beginning, we must go through some healing phases as a portion of the intestine gets healed with a portion of the urethra or water tube through which we urinate. And we certainly wait for a certain number of weeks for these water tubes from the kidneys called ureters to heal up with that sphere. But eventually, all tubes are removed and patients are able to indeed urinate. And yes, we were able to do the whole removal of the bladder and lymph nodes and the connection of everything using the robotic assistance.
And as you said, with a minimal incision and therefore less of the potential problems when you do an open procedure and you basically have to cut the person wide open and all the potential hazards that occur with that.
Sure. I do not wish to overstate the advantage of robotic assistance, as recent studies do show that you can do this operation as good
either way.
But certainly in Mr. Sestera's case, he went home after 3 days of surgery. He has had minimal pain. He looked fantastic immediately after surgery on day one, and we were quite pleased, and we felt that in his specific case, ability of our department and us to perform this operation may have shaved or saved him from some of the perioperative prolonged course associated with some of the open procedures that we do.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with urologist Dr. Gennady Bratslavsky and cancer survivor Alan Sestera. We're talking about his bladder reconstruction. So tell us about the operation. How long did it take? And you were the one who did it, am I correct?
You're correct. I did it with one of our residents, who was a chief resident, Dr. Leocario, who was a great help. We have performed this procedure together. It took us pretty much the entire day. Of course, we have to factor the certain things as anesthesia time and wake-up time. But it did take anywhere between 6 and 8 hours for the procedure. This is a procedure, again, that is a great substitute for younger patients, for those patients that do need to drain the urine somehow after the bladder comes out. And a very traditional way of draining it is through the bag, And Mr. Cisterna really wanted to avoid that option.
It's an external bag.
It's an external bag called, you know, urostomy or ileostomy. And Mr. Cisterna, being a young, vibrant, healthy, active man, who is also very self-conscientious and very responsible, felt to be a great candidate for this procedure, and we have immediately agreed to proceed with this after we certainly spoke about pluses and minuses.
Where else, I know you came from other institutions before you joined the Upstate faculty, where else have you done this procedure?
So the first time I did it was back in my training at Albany Med, and I have done these operations at National Cancer Institute, at the National Institutes of Health. There are a few institutions in this country that offer this procedure, including main cancer centers, and I'm delighted that we can offer such a technique and a procedure at Upstate here for our Central New York community.
How do you make the decision as to somebody? You mentioned certain factors, his age, his activity level. Perhaps he had no premorbid or other kind of medical concerns. How do you make the decision on who's a good candidate for this type of surgery?
Yeah, it's a great question. There are several factors that come into it in terms of where the cancer is located into a bladder, age of a patient, patient's sense of responsibility and ability to appreciate when something is not right. Often is a patient's preference, because there are some patients who are absolutely adamant about not ever having to potentially having to put a catheter in their new bladder. And just this possibility often turns many patients off, and they gladly choose to have a bag or external appliance as they are not willing to consider it. There is always a possibility of what is called a nighttime urinary incontinence that happens even in the best hands, and it happens even in the most highest volume centers. And for some patients, appreciation of a possibility of even having to wear a pad at nighttime is a no-no. So it's a risk and benefit discussion, but in most cases, and for many patients, it's a very informed decision. And I think the role of a surgeon is to actually go over closely over the, all the options and understanding what exactly the potential pitfalls may be with choosing one or the other.
And are there follow-up procedures necessary, or is it, again, dependent on the specific case in terms of chemo, other ancillary treatments, chemo, radiation, that kind of thing?
Any patient with bladder cancer requires a lifelong follow-up. So Mr. Cisterna and I have become close friends because we see each other regularly, sometimes outside the office, but most of the time in the office. But the lifelong surveillance is required, and much will depend on the final disease pathology. And Mr. Cisterna has done extremely well. I'm knocking on the wood.
How long ago was his procedure done?
So we're coming close to...
A little over 2.5 years.
Over wow. 2.5, coming closer to 3 years. And in somebody with a lymph node positive disease, I think it's very important to appreciate that we're doing quite well. But we took out many, many nodes of him very aggressively, so I think that has contributed to his success.
In the very little bit of time we have left, tell us, Mr. Cisterna, what lessons have you learned? What would you like to share with other people about your...
If you are, in my case, if you're having symptoms that seem inexplicable, ask the doctors for all the tests available. A test was not offered to me because it was known the insurance companies would not pay for it. And had that test been run a year earlier, I would not have had an advanced cancer. So ask about available tests, regardless of whether the insurance will pay for it.
And how are you feeling?
Are you kidding? I am excellent.
Just oh, my goodness.
Couldn't be happy. Couldn't be better.
Wonderful story. Thank you so very much for coming in. My guests have been Dr. Gennady Bratslavsky, Professor and Chair of Urology at Upstate Medical University, and Alan Cisterna, bladder cancer survivor. Once again, thanks for sharing your story. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. for some expert advice from the experts at Upstate. Gail Bannock from the Upstate Poison Center will explain some new regulations regarding the disposal of medications.
Thank you, Linda. We were so pleased to see that the DEA has finally decided that there will be amended regulations that will allow pharmacies to take medications back at individual pharmacies rather than having people dispose of them by throwing them in the garbage or down the toilet or wherever it may be. For many years, that was not reality. And even though at this point in time there is no directive as to who will be paying for this, whether it's the pharmaceutical companies, whether it'll be the individual pharmacies, we don't know that yet. But we do know that steps are in place so that hopefully within the next few months this will be something that will become a reality. And I have no doubts that some of the pharmacies in our area will step up to the plate to be collectors of these of the drugs. So in the past, what we've done is had drug collection days. This is what the DEA has sponsored through the White House. And so twice a year, there have been set up points in communities with law enforcement involved because they have to be according to regulations. And then they take the product, whatever they collect, to a burn site. The good news is it got a lot of drugs off the streets. The bad news is it was only twice a year. So the Poison Control Center got involved in probably 2006, I believe. We had the very first drug collection day, and at that time there were about, we collected about 100 surveys. And of the people who returned the drugs on that particular day at three different sites, most of them said that they were so glad to see an opportunity to get rid of the drugs because they didn't know what to do with them. And we always say is if the drugs are available, someone will find them if they want to, right? So when you look at some of the surveys, we see that 12 million people used drugs non-medically in 2010. And if you look at the number of prescriptions that are written and you look at the number of overdoses, I mean, just in opiates alone, we've quadrupled in the past 10 years. Heroin doubled in the past 2 years. You can see that this is a great opportunity for communities to be able to return their drugs to a pharmacy, make it simple, get them off the streets and out of your medicine cabinet.
Next up, how recent breakthroughs in the creation of 3D brain tissue may unlock the secrets of neurological diseases like Alzheimer's. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen with your Healthy Monday Minute for this week. Make time for hobbies. Hobbies and special interests are one of the best ways to unwind after a long day and combat stress. Not only do they take your mind off what was troubling you, they refocus your attention on something that you truly love to do. This week, set aside at least 15 minutes each day to focus on a hobby or personal interest. Whether it's gardening, reading, listening to music, or playing with your pets, everyone has at least a few favorite activities that provide instant happiness. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Well, much has been learned about the human brain in the past 50 years, but despite this, it remains one of the least understood organs in the human body because of its complexity and the difficulty of studying the physiology in the living body. We'll hear with more on a new medical science breakthrough that promises to unlock more of the answers to our questions as to how the brain functions is Dr. Robert Corona, professor and chair of pathology and the vice president for innovation and business development at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Corona. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a brand new breakthrough. Tell us more about it. You know, it seems like very exciting stuff.
Well, for many years, we've been trying to find a model that would substitute for using animals in research about the brain. And we've dabbled with tissue cultures. They're very persnickety, very difficult to maintain, keep alive. And these researchers were able to replicate the brain's structure and function better than anybody to date. The brain has the gray matter where all the neurons rest, and then the white matter where the processes that extend off the neurons move. And they were able to create different mediums to replicate the brain.
And one feature of it, from what I gather and the little bit I read, is that prior to this, any materials that they had tried to replicate were more what they call two-dimensional. And this has more of the three-dimensional qualities of brain tissue that more closely replicate in vivo what really exists.
Exactly. So the brain is a three-dimensional structure, and we often think of it as the cells and the processes that come off the cells. But there's a lot of other infrastructure that keep its three-dimensionality. So these scientists were able to replicate that using gels and kind of a sponge material, which allows the cell culture to function most like the brain.
And also the kinds of things that we study, like the dysfunction or brain injuries, obviously require this tissue that we studied to reflect very closely both the gray and white matter of the brain, because they affect... From what I've read, they're affected differently by any kind of injury or problem with brain functioning.
Exactly. So the white matter, if you will, that has the processes that come off the neurons, those are heavily myelinated or insulated by special cells in the white matter. That's what gives the white color, and those cells can be disrupted, and then the myelin can leave the axons, the processes. That's much what happens in multiple sclerosis. In the spinal cord, we've often tried to figure out ways to regenerate spinal cord due to spinal cord injury. And through freezing and other methodologies using steroids to prevent the inflammation, we've tried to regenerate nervous tissue to get function back. And what we see happen often is when those processes try to resprout off of the neurons, even though they grow, they don't grow in the right direction. So they never quite make the reconnection at the other side, and that's why you don't get recovery from spinal injury often.
Hence, we need something that mimics more closely what really does exist. In other words, in order to study and figure out why, when we try to make these changes to improve a situation, why they don't work.
That's correct.
And the other piece that I thought was interesting is that these cells, which was the first, I guess, also a major breakthrough, can now be kept alive in the lab longer than ever before. Tell us about that.
That's true. It's very difficult to keep a cell alive. As you'd imagine, our body is exquisite in its ability to keep cells alive in a perfect temperature and a perfect environment with adequate oxygen. And monitoring these cell cultures and keeping the perfect environment is difficult to do, and the scientists were able to do it and keep these cultures alive for several months.
So what potential, obviously you've alluded to the potential that it offers, what does it offer us, this type of cell material?
I think it's an incredible opportunity to research all the disorders that impact the nervous system, from degenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and ALS and Huntington's disease to chronic traumatic brain injury, which we see in the public eye now with all the football players getting premature dementia and Alzheimer's disease, and other head traumas that occur in our soldiers that are coming back from overseas. All of these individual entities that impact the brain could be studied better with the cell cultures?
I think that they've done some studies to date. Are you familiar with the kinds of things they've actually done to date using this tissue?
Mostly it's been studied in trauma. And I think because that impacts young people, being able to evaluate trauma with a tissue culture is superior to our other models that we have.
So we can begin to understand what happens in trauma and then hence maybe how to be more protective or interventional after trauma occurs.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Robert Corona, and we're talking about a bioengineered 3D brain tissue and how it can promote the study of brain disorders. So help us understand, how significant really is this in terms of, you know, getting this deep understanding of brain physiology? What do you see in your crystal ball?
Well, one of the things is I am a neuropathologist, so I study, brain tissue, both live patients for biopsies and in autopsy material. And it's such a complicated organ, and this allows us to study the brain tissue and its function, which we haven't been able to in the past. We're also quite excited about the fact that at Upstate we're going to have access to stem cells that will come from what was traditionally medical waste from the umbilical cord of delivered babies.
Tell us a little bit more about that. I'm not sure our listeners are familiar with the cord blood bank that's going to be established.
So Upstate on our community general campus is building a cord blood center, which is a very unique in Upstate New York. There are only 20 across the country. It's a public cord blood bank where we ask moms and dads permission to take the placenta after a delivery and use what was once medical waste to obtain about 150 milliliters of blood. And then we'll cull out the stem cells, which are primitive cells that can differentiate into many different types of cells.
So they have equipotentiality. They could become, give us examples of what they could become.
They could become heart tissue, liver tissue. Here we're talking about brain tissue. And they are very primitive, so they can differentiate. We use them to do transplants. Their primitive nature allows kind of a universal donor type cell for leukemia transplants. So
let me just, I'm not trying to interrupt you, but one of the things I think is very, very hopeful but also somewhat confusing to people, when we use the term stem cells, historically there's been all of this kind of negative buzz around it because it usually meant taking the blood of an unborn fetus, for example, an aborted fetus, and using that. In this case, we're avoiding all of those medical, ethical, and religious issues and taking what, as you mentioned, would have been tossed away after the birth of a baby, and harvesting those stem cells and using them to do what? I mean, exactly what would the stem cells be able to do?
Well, I just want to emphasize your point is this is placenta and cord. It has nothing to do with the fetus. And traditionally, we would just examine this, and then it would be disposed of very respectfully. But now we'll ask permission of the family to donate the blood, and then the stem cells that are within the blood will be used for research in a number of areas. Specifically, the area I'm interested in is in nervous system degeneration. I mean, why do we get Alzheimer's disease? Why do we get Parkinson's disease? Why do we get certain psychiatric diseases? Why do the neurons degenerate? And polio, why do they degenerate? And Lou Gehrig's disease or ALS, why the neurons degenerate? We don't quite know why these neurons are selectively vulnerable to certain genetics and environmental factors. And so this will allow us to study that.
And also then eventually to treat, isn't that the idea?
That would be the hope, that like in Parkinson's disease now, get into certain areas of the brain, deep in the brain itself, and even into the brain stem, to put cells in there that make dopamine. And so if you can take stem cells and nurture them and create cultures that create neurons that make dopamine, for instance, that would be a treatment for Parkinson's disease.
So the bottom line is these stem cells and the information now that you've culled even from some of this early research with the 3D brain tissue could actually provide treatments for very, very specific currently neurological disorders and potential trauma.
Absolutely.
Where the stem cells could be used to actually be sent into the body as little messengers, and they would then unfold or create themselves as a different type of cell and heal, so to speak, heal
Correct.
The body.
They'll differentiate based on the environment where they exist. The other thing we can learn is how to keep neurons healthy. So, for instance, if an individual had damaged brain cells from a head trauma, and we learn what environment nurtures those cells back to good health, we can do that in a culture and add certain nutrients into that environment to make those neurons become healthy again. So that could be a promising opportunity for drug development.
At this point, how far away from those kinds of efforts are we when you talk about this early? This was done at Tufts, I believe.
Correct, right.
And they're biomedical engineers. What does that mean exactly, and how is that different from someone in a medical capacity such as yourself?
So these are engineers that have specialized in human biology often, sometimes other, animal biology, but they're engineers that understand human physiology. In my other career in industry, I worked with a lot of biomedical engineers, and they are outstanding colleagues for physicians to work with because they understand the engineering aspect. And so many devices that are developed today are developed by biomedical engineers.
So where are they in this process, I guess? I mean, in terms of, and a little bit of time we have left, what do you foresee in terms of a time frame? I'm not going to pin you down, but as you look forward in terms of this early breakthrough, how far away are we from perhaps developing some kind of a treatment using stem cells or the information gleaned from this type of tissue for a treatment for something like Parkinson's or Alzheimer's?
I mean, I think we're already there in many areas. So we're close in a number of areas. It's an iterative process where we keep refining and getting better and learning. But there are already people using stem cells in helping neurologic disorders and other disorders, regenerating organs. We're talking about three-dimensional printing of organs based on a lattice work and using stem cells to go on top of that lattice. There are people that have already developed a trachea. There are people that are looking to develop a liver. And so it's incredibly promising, and especially if you couple it with next-generation genetic sequencing so that we understand the blueprint of tissue in tumors, we can start to work to customize and personalize both the diagnostics and the therapy.
So you get your own liver. In other words, one that's custom-made for you should
that's right.
you need it.
That's right.
I can just picture, shelves of potential livers, but, one that's been made just for you. It's pretty amazing stuff. Right. Thank you so much for coming in. This is fascinating and very, very exciting, and it's exciting to know that right here in Central New York, we're going to participate and be a part of this whole incredible revolution. My guest has been Dr. Robert Corona, professor and chair of pathology and the vice president for innovation and business development at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Poet and sometime patient Kathleen Grieger from Wisconsin offers healthcare professionals some hard-earned wisdom. Sometimes what we interpret as patient noncompliance is actually a patient trying to explain why they want us to choose the other arm for our needle stick. Here is her poem, The Race. The seizure eclipses my speech. Thoughts remain, yet hushed from within. With a need to control my mind quickly, they chase time trying to start the IV. One nurse grabs a left arm. the other the right, and I feel they're competing for me. Clutching my left hand, she slaps it, a snake charmer, trying to make my vein rise. I dread what she seeks to accomplish, as her skill promotes silence in me. I wrest my arm loose, and she grabs it, saying, "Silly, there's nothing to fear." I cannot touch my pen, and unable to talk, can't convey how this hand sets me free, how I write, how I sign, how I'm able to speak. My hand mute, distress stays with me. The vein blows. I breathe a long sigh as she scouts for a new one. I tremble. The other yells out, "You can stop now, I'm in." Her needle in place, my release. Success brings reprieve. Apprehension steps out. Relief comes in waves over me. My language has not been expelled, and the shaking is calmed within me.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we answer the question, can your job give you cancer? Plus, a medical journey into the death of President Warren Harding, and how recent research into the human cytomegalovirus may hold the promise to help treat other serious illnesses. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website. That's HealthLinkOnAir, that's all one word, .org. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Serio and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.